The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Jeffrey Clayton is the executive director of the American Bail Coalition. Jeffrey, thanks for being on the program today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
All right. Set this up for us, because I remember that as voters, we were going to get the chance to reject this no bail thing. And then I think voters did want to have bail. And now there's people in Sacramento that don't care about the voters, and they're bringing back the no bail or something like it. Take us into this story. We're so busy with our workaday world, these things slip by us, and they're very, very impactful. Very scary stuff, letting people out without paying bail. Walk us into this story.
Absolutely. So in 2018, legislation was passed to basically eliminate bail in California, use a computer algorithm to decide who was in and who was out. And that was what the voters voted on, Proposition 25, this past November, rejected it by an 11-point margin, which really we took to mean that they want to keep the right to bail. They like the present system. And obviously, that's not to say that there can't be some reforms, but by and large, they like the system. So in January, Senator Robert Hertzberg, who carried the original bill along with Assemblyman now, Attorney General Bonta, introduced Senate Bill 262, which was essentially a bill to take what the Supreme Court did during the pandemic, the zero bail schedule, and mandate zero bail in all those crimes across California, and then ultimately it morphed into another bill at the end, only to be shelved and now to be looked at sometime in the future.
Okay, so the argument on the other side is that, oh, you know, there are some people who have been accused of a crime and they just don't have the resources to have the same access to be out on bail as the rest of us. And therefore, we've got to do something to make it more fair. You've heard that, right?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the argument was answered and the question was answered by the California Supreme Court earlier in the year when they said, hey, listen, after a certain period of time, you know, when the bail set by a bail schedule or a judge, we're going to have to look at this and we're going to require prosecutors to put on more proof to make sure that's not the only reason they're there. In other words, they are a significant flight risk or they are a significant danger. And so the California Supreme Court has set up a procedural way where we're going to make sure that people aren't there solely because they can't afford bail. And certainly, you know, the entire criminal justice system is harder on people without resources. I mean, we know that. We know the O.J. Simpson case. We know all that. But, you know, I think they've done a good job at trying to balance that issue with, you know, the interest of the public, which is public safety.
Yeah. Now, they can also say, well, you have a stake in the game, that you represent people who are in the bail industry, and they essentially could be wiped out if they're not making these bail kind of loans with bonds. You know, it's a money thing, just like teachers union don't like it when you talk about, you know, charter schools or school choice. Right. I mean, they're going to say you're not the guy to speak because you've got a hand in the till.
That's true. But I like to just focus on the merits. And I think, you know, we allow people to exercise a constitutional right. That's why we're different than other industries. Other industries are things that are nice to haves or, you know, different schools or different things like that. Manufacturing plastic bags, for example, which was a referendum several years ago, we can go to paper. Well, we can't go to another constitutional right. So the other thing that I think is the reality is that we help people who can't afford 100% bail to get out. And that's a positive thing. And the other thing that we do is we do a better job because of the arrest powers, that we can threaten to arrest and or arrest the person and have their family involved so that it actually performs a better service to the state. Yeah. Of California.
But isn't this whole era of reduced bail part of that same thing that's happening with, you know, DAs like Gascon and the one in San Francisco that they're looking for some sort of equity in justice? People have been poor people, minorities have been impacted more severely in the criminal justice system. So let's swing the bar the other way. Let's make it no bail. Isn't that really what it's about?
That is really what it was about. And I think this land a Park case in Sacramento is a perfect example of that, where we go, well, the guy is, it's attempted auto theft, so let's automatically give him a zero bail. Well, turns out he was a two striker, had a severe drug problem and a record a mile long, ultimately murders a woman and her dogs while he was on that zero bail that he failed to appear on. And so, yes, we have to look at the offender, and we can't just draw lines saying we don't like this, so we'll just get rid of it. That's not how it works in the criminal justice system at all. That's not a good solution at all.
No. It's interesting how the system works. There's, you know, judges and prosecutors have no stake in the game. If they get, there's a story that I was just looking at. I mean, this one really got me. A guy out in the Inland Empire just got an $11 million settlement because the prosecutors convicted a guy, and now later on DNA evidence shows he didn't do the crime. I mean, he gave up 20 years of his life and he gets $11 million. And I know it's one of those hypothetical things where, you know, I was thinking for a second, I'd like to have $11 million, but would I want to give up 20 years of my life? There is something about the prosecution system that is about getting people, about winning prosecutions. How do we balance that, this adversarial system, with the bail system? Where does it all fit? Because stuff like that doesn't look good either. $11 million having to be paid out with tax money because some prosecutor convicted a guy who didn't do it.
No, it's governmental immunity, right? It's the king's law. It's we can shield prosecutions and judges from negligent acts that, you know, other people wouldn't be able to get away with. Attorneys in private practice wouldn't be able to get away with. The reality is that, you know, the burden of the prosecutors to do substantial justice. But the problem right now is that nobody who is pro-criminal justice reform wants to invest in prosecutors. But that's what we need to do, is we need more fair-minded, balanced, experienced people in there to make individualized determinations, and more of them. Because if you see the caseloads, and if you've ever practiced criminal law, I mean, good luck getting a district attorney to call you back. It just doesn't happen at the misdemeanor level in particular, but even in felonies, you can often never get a phone call back because they're too overburdened and they can't practice law like everybody else.
So. And speaking of the misdemeanor level, what happened a few years ago? Voters were duped into saying, oh, let's not pick on these guys too hard. Let them steal 900 and whatever dollars each time and get their calculator out when they rip people off. And let's just not worry about prosecuting them because they're only misdemeanors. What has that brought us? That has brought us what you talk about, repeat offenders, lessen the quality of our life, increased your chances of having your place broken into, your car stolen, even, you know, other crimes. These bad dudes do bad things, and there ought to be a system that, you know, either doesn't give them bail or makes bail tough. The idea of letting everyone walk because it's hard on a few doesn't seem to cut it, does it?
No, and it's really about the offender, not the crime at this point. We have to hold people accountable for what they do when it's negative and it affects society and they keep doing it over and over again. And that goes for shoplifting. And obviously what you've seen in California is we downgrade a bunch of felonies to misdemeanors. And then we say, well, misdemeanors are not important, so forget them. But those were former felony cases. And as you say, you know, yeah, you do have offenders walking around with calculators in their pocket. And that's a real case that I've used around the country where the guy had calculated he was just under the felony threshold and there was nothing they could do to him.
Okay, so where are we now in all this process? Where is Hertzberg's bill? Did that get approved, and is it the governor's sign it, or has it been shelved? What's going on? Because I know things happen fast in Sacramento. What is the very latest as we tape this?
Absolutely. Last week it got out of the Senate, and then it got to the Assembly, where it was made a two-year bill, basically at the 11th hour, which means that it will come back, and it'll be discussed in the interim. The legislature will reconvene in January, and they could run it early, but based on all the opposition and all the different interest groups involved, we expect it will take a little bit longer before they start talking about what might be the solution.
Yeah, and what can our listeners do if they want to be tough on crime and they don't want to see the bail system gone? People sometimes ask, well, you know, I'm just an average citizen. What can I do to impact something like this? How do you get your voice heard? What do you need to happen in order to kill this thing or to get something that's a good plan through?
Well, you can go to visit us on the internet, AA Bail Coalition, or Twitter and Facebook. There's also an outlet called Safer Communities where you can email your legislator and where there's updates put on about where the legislation is, what it does, and what you can do about it, whether you want to call them, email them, or tweet them. Your view, it does have an impact, and they do look at that.
Say that web address again. It went by way too fast.
You can go to our website, ambailcoalition.org, or you can go to Facebook and look up Safer Communities.
All right. Now, final minute. Give us some of these, for instance. How bad is it out there with these reductions taking place? And we're not the only place in the country that's kind of playing with this, are we?
No, I look at Houston, Texas as the comparable example. You've got a major city. You've got a district attorney like Gascon, elected by George Soros, who ran on bail reform, who went through a bail reform for 4 years and 2 weeks ago issued a scathing report saying it didn't work. Pretrial crime has tripled. People showing up in court, they aren't doing it. It's become a total mess. The number of people on multiple felony bonds out at the same time has increased dramatically. They had one guy that was out on, I want to say, like 13 felony bonds at the same time. So it's just created a mess. And I think that example and other examples like that, the city of San Francisco, which is, has a 49% failure to appear rate, are going to change the conversation as we go forward, knowing that these policies just didn't work.
So explain to our listeners why they don't appear and why bail gets them to appear and what the bail hunter does, because a lot of us don't really know the fine details about how this works. What makes it work versus not work?
It's security for your release. In other words, you're putting up something that you stand to lose if you don't show up. And in California, 95% of people who post bail will use a bail agent, which means typically there's a third party involved with the bail agent that's posting the bond for you, both of whom are liable if you don't show up. And then, of course, everybody's familiar with Dog the Bounty Hunter or bail agent recovery that do have arrest powers across state lines. So if you flee and they can go international, a lot of suspects are hunted internationally from California. They will arrest you and return you to court. Otherwise, they'll have to pay the entire amount of the bond.
So it's skin in the game because these people who put up the bail bond have, you know, in your interest that you show up. If you don't show, they're going to come looking for you, whereas the government, he just didn't show. They're not going to do anything, are they?
Absolutely. I posted your bond. I can lose my assets, and the bail bondsman can lose their assets. So as a team, we're going to do everything we can to get you back.
Last 30 seconds, though, and on the other side, when they say, hey, a poor guy can't afford this, they don't have anything to put up. They don't have any money to even buy that bond. They're stuck in jail.
Well, that doesn't usually happen in California unless it's a severe offender, and they're probably not going to get out anyway. So California has alternatives for poor people in low-level cases, by and large. So when somebody's stuck in jail, it's generally for a reason. It's generally because they've committed a violent or serious felony.
Jeffrey Clayton is Executive Director of the American Bail Coalition. Thanks for joining us and talking about this story. Obviously, because it's a two-year bill, it'll be back, right?
It sure will.
Thank you much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care now. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
His book is titled Saving California. Stephen Greenhut from the R Street Institute is joining us. Steve, as always, it's good to talk with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
What is the R Street Institute?
It is a free market think tank based in D.C., and I'm the Western director out here in Sacramento area.
Great. And in Saving California, I take it you identify and deal with some of the challenges in this state, don't you?
Yeah, so that book, I was the editor of the book. I wrote some of it, but it's mostly a variety of experts. Did it for the Pacific Research Institute. And the bottom line is there are a whole lot of problems the state has, enduring problems. And there are a lot of solutions that we just seem to be ignoring. So whatever, as I wrote it before the recall, and put it together before the recall, and the whole purpose of the book is to have a kind of a blueprint for reform, regardless of what happens with political, with elections. I mean, elections come and go, and nothing ever seems to really change in the state. So I just thought we'd lay out, it was timed with the recall just because there was the discussion of so much discussion about the state's problems and the politics of the state. It has nothing to do with the recall or the election, but there's just some ideas for fixing the state, and anybody from either party could embrace them. And we just thought we'd lay it out there and have some discussion about these ideas.
Let's do it. Before we do it, though, I was looking at one of the left-leaning newspapers that was attacking the Republican candidate in the recall, and then after it's all done, goes around and says, Well, actually, the Democrats kind of own these problems because, you know, even with the recall, they've been in power all these years. So they're probably going to have to solve them one way or the other. So I guess where do we start? Do you have them in alphabetical order or by chapter? I mean, let's start with the fires, because it's been a real tough season. As we were recording this, the famed sequoias are potentially in threat up in central and northern, I guess, central California, into the mountains, inland a bit, in Sequoia there. And people say, well, how come nothing gets done? I mean, you know, why? Some people complain lack of forestation policies. We don't clear things out. We got the, you know, the people, the tree huggers that don't want anything done there. And others say, we got to do that. What did you identify on the fires is the problem? And what's the solution?
Yeah, so there's a pretty in-depth chapter from Dan Kolke, an attorney, and he's got a deep history, political history in the state, and it's a fascinating chapter. And a lot of what, when you get down to wildfires, it's a good example of some of the problems that California faces, because there's a lot of it isn't exciting, right? A lot of the policy, a lot of the things we ought to be doing. So we saw that Governor Newsom, Cap Radio did an investigative report and found that the governor overstated the amount of land clearance that the state's been doing, and you know that's part of it is just cleaning up, maintaining the forests that we have. We could be using, for instance, one idea that Dan pointed out was using the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. For things that actually relate to firefighting and to land cleanup and maintenance. And, so he calls for the governor to urge the congressional delegation to insist that the Forest Service dramatically increase the number of acres of federal lands that are thinned, tax incentives, to help homeowners in those wild land urban interfaces, some reasonable land use restrictions, and then again that using funds that are already available through the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund to accomplish some of these things. And part of the problem, and Dan argued it could actually help the state meet its climate change goals. And in my view, what we the state leaders continually do is they point to climate change as the cause of so many problems. And I don't doubt that there's climate change. It's just that the goal should be of state public policy is to make the state more resilient in the face of whatever the climate's doing, rather than trying to have press conferences and take symbolic positions that are designed to prod the rest of the country or the rest of the world into changing the entire climate. So a lot of the climate problem comes from China and India, and California presumably has little control over what's done in developing parts of the world. So another issue, with wildfires, although the chapter doesn't get into it that much, are insurance related matters. Changing some of the insurance rules, we make it very difficult for insurers to price policies that reflect the risk, thanks to Prop 103. And as a result, we end up subsidizing people to build in areas where maybe if the price of the insurance reflected the amount of risk, they'd be less apt to do so. So there's a lot of California's public policy problems are they're boring, right? I mean, and politicians like to do these grandiose things. They like to be saving the world, when in many cases what they need to do is dealing with electrical utility regulations relating to, a lot of times the electrical wires spark fires. We need to deal with liability issues and insurance issues and land clearance issues. I mean, in Arizona, how we use prison inmates to fight fires. In Arizona, they also use them to clear out land and clear out some of the underbrush. So there are a lot of things we could do that would make us more resilient in the face of wildfires.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, I noticed a few years ago I hadn't been to let's say, the mountains in our community. And then I went back up there, and it was like, whoa, look at all the housing that has gone in right next to these pine trees and everything else. You know, isn't that a risk? And you're right. You've identified that as long as it's inexpensive to build there and it doesn't carry with it the risk in paying for it, then people are going to build where it's dangerous and we're going to subsidize it. Then it burns down and then we bring in FEMA and help pay to rebuild them. And then it's like kicking ourselves in the rear on this stuff. We have such bad policy. But you're right. It's not sexy. It's boring stuff. And it ends up on a show on Sunday morning like mine to talk about it. But it's really important things, because if we don't fix these, it's just going to keep happening. All right. So you identified the forest issue. You pointed out some things that need to be changed. What's another issue you cover that California needs to be saved from?
Yeah. So Lance Izumi from Pacific Research Institute goes into some of the education reforms. He's an education expert, and our state needs a more competitive education system. Charter schools have been a great success in California, and yet Governor Newsom has signed a package of teacher union backed bills that make it more difficult for charters to expand or start anew. And, Jerry Brown was a big supporter of charter schools, and now under the new administration, less so. And that's, returning to a support for a boisterous support for some sort of school choice. And charters, there are other forms of school choice, some of which I think would be even better, but within our public school system, school charters are an excellent thing, especially for poor kids. But the teachers unions hate them because they seem to spotlight the current system's inadequacy, and they also view the public schools, even though they've been getting an increasing amount of the budget, and under Prop 98 get more than 40% of all the general fund dollars. We're getting a lot more administration, a lot more building, but we're not getting better outcomes. So we need to be focused more on educational outcomes. So that's another area.
It's an interesting one in that you mentioned the unions, and they are by far one of the largest supporters of the Democrat governor and many lawmakers. And so it becomes very difficult for them to reform those things. That makes it very tough, doesn't it?
Well, sure. The vested interests are always a problem, and so I'm a big fan of competition. So, the schools want us to just keep giving them more money, and they keep getting more money, and we're not getting a lot of improvement in education. So,
got time for one more quick one. Time flies. Give us one more.
Yeah. So, okay. Housing. Wendell Cox, a well-known housing expert, points to a variety of things. One of, impact fee reform. I mean, we have such high impact fees, streamlining CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act. He calls for something I hadn't heard before, a housing opportunity area in the interior of California to restore, competitive housing markets. Now, the legislature did, to its credit, pass, and the governor did, to his credit, sign. I'm actually a big supporter of SB 9 and SB 10.
Now, what do you say real quick? Got about a minute left. The people who oppose it, they're worried about it because they think suddenly you're going to have, four houses and a lot that handles one, no place for people to park, lots of noise, all the different things that go wrong.
Well, the current suburban situation now is a creation of government, the zoning. This loosens up zoning and allows property owners to do more things with their property. It also, it eliminates CEQA in those projects. It gives ministerial approvals as opposed to subjective approvals by bureaucrats. That's all things that conservatives should applaud. Yeah. I think those are good bills, and I do give credit to the governor for signing those.
They get worried though. They get worried of things changing in NIMBY, not in my backyard. They don't want to see big towers going up and all that. Hey, real quick, got 30 seconds. Put a plug in for the book. What's it titled?
Yes.
Where do you get it?
Saving California, Solutions to the State's Biggest Policy Problems, available at the online bookseller of your choice.
Stephen Greenhut, who, by the way, a few years ago, I was walking along, don't know what street it was in Sacramento, maybe one north of the Capitol or something like that. And I happened to see you there. So good to see you in Sacramento.
Yeah, hope to bump into you again sometime. So,
take care now.
Thanks for having me.
Yep. Bye-bye. If you would like to hear Politics and Issues anytime you wish, you can check out our podcast. We take our broadcast program, this one, and put it up there for you to listen to anytime. You can go to am590theanswer.com, look for local shows and podcasts, and there you go. You'll see Politics and Issues, and you can download it or sign up to have it delivered right to your smartphone. Stay right there. We're coming back with more right after this.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer. You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Immigration, a hot topic in Washington. Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson grilling Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas during a Senate Homeland Security Committee hearing.
Of the 1.3 million people that we've apprehended, how many people have been returned? How many people are being detained? And how many people have been dispersed? And I want some numbers here.
His response to that question?
Senator, I do not have that data.
Why not?
For me.
Why don't you have that basic information?
Senator, I want to be accurate in the information.
I'm looking for ballpark figures. Is it about half? Have we dispersed about half of that? Are we up to about 600,000 people we dispersed?
Was there misconduct or a misunderstanding? There is apparent outrage over some images that reportedly show Border Patrol agents using the reins of their horses to whip Haitian nationals who cross the border in Texas. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas says that will not be tolerated.
We commenced an investigation in my direction immediately.
But it turns out the agents, expert horsemen, were only spinning their horse reins to keep the Haitian migrants from getting too close to the huge animals, possibly getting hurt or worse. Some media outlets mistakenly reported that the agents were taking whips to the migrants. Jim Ellis of EllisInsight.com joins us to talk about all these stories and more. Jim, let's start with the border and the Haitian migrants and the dust-up about the horses and some misunderstanding there on reins and how you use them and everybody quick to blame the Border Patrol. Either way, it doesn't look good for Biden. Your reaction?
No, not much does. And, you know, it's pretty stunning after just 8 months in office how fast this administration has been able to really drive us towards the third world. And it's really astonishing. And I think that Biden, and with all of his experience, remember when foreign affairs and all of the domestic experience he's had with his years and years in the Senate as vice president. And that was one reason that people should elect him, right? Because he had all this great experience. But boy, they've made a lot of rookie mistakes. And it's astonishing, really, just how bad things have gotten so fast.
Take this thing with the migrants, the Haitian migrants. Either the Biden administration is lying when they say they're sending them home, because even the AP has interviewed people who said, no, they're not. They're sending most of them into the U.S. with a show-up form. You know, Fox News has covered that as well. So, you know, you can't even trust the administration for saying what they're doing with these migrants.
Apparently not.
And then you have the issue with the reins of the horse. You have Maxine Waters shocked and outraged. Well, you know what, Maxine Waters, if you're shocked and outraged, the person to be shocked and outraged is not Donald Trump. He's not the president anymore. It's Biden. If indeed they were allegedly whipping them, which they're not, and nobody has proven that they are, that's an interesting story as it is. And the media quick to point out the whipping story, isn't it?
Yes, when they have this horrendous problem at the border, and that's what they're going to concentrate on. But that's so typical. I mean, it's just ridiculous, the situation that we're in now as a country, and again, such a short amount of time.
Yeah. And then the administration's not talking about it anymore either. The botched withdrawal of U.S. forces from Afghanistan. The administration won't discuss it. They've moved on. By the way, if you ask questions now at a White House press opportunity or photo op, the administration has all these employees start to make noise and shout down the reporter questions. That's kind of an interesting story. You do that long enough, the media starts to turn against you, and they're doing it to the left-wing media, too.
Well, again, just astonishing things we're seeing. And I think, again, just 8 months in office, and I think Biden is already exceeded Jimmy Carter as being the worst president of the United States in history.
Well, he obviously can't answer questions, or they wouldn't turn to his own people to shout down in the room to be able to stop it. There was a story that Boris Johnson fielded more questions in the Oval Office than Biden did.
Yes. Again, it's almost to the point where nothing is surprising anymore. And, they're going to prop Biden up for as long as they can. I mean, who's really running things? And I think the answer is people behind him, Ron Klain and Susan Rice. And I mean, I think these are the people making the real decisions. And it's so I think we're going to continue to see this pattern the rest of his administration, and it's probably going to get worse.
We had Mayorkas being questioned this week in a Senate hearing over just how many migrants have been let into this country and how many have been sent home, and he couldn't answer the question and wouldn't because he claimed he didn't have the numbers. He wanted to be accurate about it, and the one grilling him said, no, just ballpark, and he wouldn't answer the question. That doesn't look good either.
Well, and apparently they think they can get away with anything, and so far they have.
The left-wing media won't air those sound clips, will they?
No, they won't. And then let's just see how much the Republicans continue to push this thing, because they probably won't. And, and I think that now with this media blackout we have of all these key issues, I think what's going to happen, particularly next year, is the campaigns are going to have to be educational as well as running for the office, because people aren't going to know a lot of what's going on because of this media blackout. And of course, the administration is just going to tell them different things. And, again, it's just going to be, I think, rather a fascinating time, because campaigns are going to have to transform themselves, and not just running for office, but educating the people as to what's really happening. So, and hopefully these candidates will understand that.
So why does the media go in the tank for one side over another? I mean, my theory is that the young people coming up who go into J schools, journalism schools, are left-wing liberal elites. You know, they're pampered by their parents. They never really do anything. They don't, they've never ridden a horse, so they don't understand what reins are and how you use them and how you have to turn the horse and use the reins to keep the Haitians from getting in the horse's path and being injured. I mean, they won't tell you that story. They lack knowledge. They have predisposed opinions, and then they go into these careers and work at news outlets that encourage that.
Yes, definitely. And then the news outlets, and you know better than I, in terms of these the journalism schools, I mean, in terms of who gets accepted, they only accept people like that.
Whatever's going on, it's not good.
No.
And the American people suffer for it. You give the example of how they're going to have to educate the candidates are, because the only story that comes out is that Border Patrol agents are using whips on Haitians. And when they do that, they don't connect the story to the Biden administration. They somehow or another, that's a leftover from Trump era, right?
Oh, of course, yeah.
And so that's the view that people will have. They'll think, oh, how awful it is. How could we do this to these suffering people? There are reports that the migrants that are supposedly from Haiti, hey, they didn't just come from Haiti. They didn't just all jump in the water and swim across. They'd actually been working at pretty good paying jobs in Brazil and then heard that the Biden administration was letting people in, and that's why they came up. You hear that on Fox News and Newsmax, but you don't hear that on NBC, CBS, ABC, and the others.
And we're not going to.
Because they have an agenda, don't they?
Yeah, they are no longer really news media. It's a propaganda machine, just like we've seen and criticized these totalitarian countries that have the same type of operations with the media.
Yeah, same. Like you think of China, for example,
right?
Because China has worked with these multinational companies who have interest there. You know, the Nikes of the world and the major networks who want to get their programming in there. Those outlets can't criticize China, can they?
No, no. And because, again, and this is where we're getting into when we look at these companies, we've seen this on some other issues, and that's what the wokeism and everything is, because they're no longer American companies. They're globalist companies. And that's a whole other coalition that we're going to have to look at from a political perspective.
And what does that portend for the future in this country if you can't point out the things that are bad for our people? For example, you know, China and the Uyghurs and the slave labor and the things that are alleged going on over there, if it's mum's the word by all these multinational corporations because they're going to get shut out of these lucrative contracts, mm-hmm. then the truth isn't heard. Jobs go to China. It's bad for the U.S.
It's very bad for the U.S., but we've got – they're almost becoming now their own coalition that's not – really part of America anymore, and that's going to be a very dangerous thing. We are facing very dangerous times.
What does this for Trump do? I mean, he is talking about a run. All this stuff just seems like, you know, what should he be doing quietly in the background now? I mean, you've got a lot of angst that would say the Biden way of doing things is wrong, but what about the Trump way? I mean, that brings up a lot of people who don't like him, too.
Well, certainly, and again, we've got a situation where you have a figure like Trump, and I don't recall, I've been involved in politics for 40 years, I don't recall anybody having this type of a strong base within a party like Trump does with the Republicans. I mean, the media will try to downplay that and try to make it look like it's just a faction, but, you know, Trump's numbers with Republicans have always been extremely high, and they were higher really than any president we've had, and it continues to grow, and I think it's going to continue to get even stronger. So the question is, what does he end up wanting to do? I think it's going to be really interesting to see how these elections turn out of these people that he endorses in these primaries. And so I think he's got to be careful as to who he endorses to be pretty selective on that to make sure that his record is good in terms of, you know, from his perspective, in terms of winning these races. Because, you know, we had those situations in the specials where he lost one of them in Texas, and then they really had to go all out to make sure their candidate in Ohio won, and he did that primary. But that's the sort of thing that they're going to have to watch, and that's how he builds an operation nationally, and I think he's on the right track to do that. And I think he's, you know, I wouldn't even think if he runs, I don't think he'll have much major opposition even for the nomination, because it's so clear he'll take it. And then we head into a general election again with him as the nominee, and then what happens? I'm absolutely 100% convinced that he will not. Or the eventual Republican nominee, whoever it may be, but probably him at this point, I think, him being Trump, they're not going to be facing Biden. It's going to be somebody else, probably Harris.
All right. Jim Ellis, ellisinsight.com. We thank you for your wise counsel. We'll see you again next week.
Thank you again.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Well, coming up, we are going to talk about heart health. And in that discussion, we're also going to talk about a very special day called World Heart Day. Joining us is Dr. Andrew Freeman, MD, FACC, FACP. Talk about having a bunch of initials that are very important. Dr. Freeman, thank you for being with us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Heart health. Obviously, our heart is really, really important, and we need to focus on it. What is the message you want to convey today?
Well, I'm always struck by how many people don't always realize that heart disease is the number one killer in the United States. And as you probably know, we all face this major epidemic, or what I call the American curse, which is we work hard our whole lives, and when we save our money, we're ready to retire. What do we look forward to? Heart attacks, strokes, dementia, peripheral arterial disease, It's a terrible way to retire. So on World Heart Day, and I would argue every day, we should really try to focus on ways to prevent heart disease, which are well within our reach, and many of us take these things for granted.
Okay, let's list off some of the things that we can all do to better our hearts. Go ahead.
So I usually tell my patients that there are five important things that you can do every single day that will have a big impact on your overall health and, of course, cardiac health. The first is diet. So all of us eat, and most of us eat without paying a lot of attention. Sometimes we just scarf down our meals and move on. But really, what we eat matters a lot. So I usually ask my patients to follow a predominantly, if not totally, low-fat, whole food, plant-based diet. So what does that mean? Well, the vast majority of us eat like kings and queens, but it sure would be smarter for us to eat more like peasants, which means whole, minimally processed foods that are plants. So oatmeal in the morning, let's say, a nice big salad at lunch with a good balsamic vinegar, maybe some brown rice or potatoes in the salad to keep us full, and then maybe a baked potato or half a baked potato with some beans and salsa and a big plate of broccoli for dinner. Sounds like it might not be so tasty, but it's surprisingly tasty and filling. And then even better is eating ethnic foods, going out for your favorite ethnic food, whatever it may be, Thai, Vietnamese, Chinese, Mexican, and tell them that you're eating plant-based, and you could almost find always something delicious. So that's one.
That's great. But before I get to do, let me just challenge you on the potato, because I had a doctor once who said, you got to watch it on those potatoes. There are a lot of starch, and you're going to get fat if you just eat those.
Yeah, so I would tell you that the potato is much maligned, but actually a surprisingly healthful and really complete type of a food. You know, it is high in energy, right? So I don't recommend you eat 10 potatoes. And if you're trying to lose weight, I would recommend eating half a potato. But those starches are what power us through the day. So I usually recommend eating some amount of starch, but not overdoing it.
Got it. Okay. Now, number two.
So number two is exercise. And it's not just exercise, right? A lot of people say they exercise. Some of my patients tell me they exercise and they're, you know, doing stretches, you know, and those are all good, but that's not the kind of exercise. It's really 30 minutes every day of breathlessness. So if you go with your spouse, partner, friend, family, whoever it may be, I want you to work at a level that it's hard for you to talk to them, but they can talk to you. So it's good for your relationship and your body. But what I usually tell people is getting to that level of breathlessness is critical. And obviously, you should check with your doctor before you begin any exercise program. But 30 minutes a day of breathlessness is really the ticket. It's not about heart rate necessarily or how many steps. It's about some of the intensity you put in. And 30 minutes a day of breathlessness is really critical.
Got it. Number three.
Number three is stress. We live in a stressful world. In fact, many of the words we use to describe stress or what manifests from stress make a lot of sense. For instance, high blood pressure is hypertension, too much tension. Even the word disease, dis-ease or lack of ease. So what I usually tell people to do is find 30 minutes a day and do something that you enjoy that's mindful. So meditate, watch the sunrise, do some yoga, go for a walk in the woods, pray, whatever you're into, but try to cast off the accumulated stress that comes from the day.
Okay, number four.
So number four is interesting. So a lot of people don't realize this, but you know, as a heart doctor, I always tell people that there's something about matters of the heart or love and connection to others that seems to improve health outcomes. So I usually tell people to strengthen relationships with people that matter to them and fix relationships or mourn them as a loss if they're not healthy. But in short, being connected to others in a regular way actually significantly improves outcomes. So I tell people that having more love in their life is important.
Number five.
Number five is often neglected by many, which is the amount of quality sleep that you get. So believe it or not, there's excellent research that shows that somewhere between 7 and 10 hours, and I usually tell people 7 hours at the minimum, of uninterrupted sleep is critical to one's overall health, including blood pressure and heart health. So I usually tell people to try to get 7 hours of uninterrupted sleep. And if they're getting interrupted, there may be something else going on, either from another body system or they have a lot of stress in their life. And we have to work on reducing that stress and exercising. But most importantly, what I tell people is it's not just one of these things. It's really having all five of these things really well balanced that improves health and particularly cardiovascular health.
Doctor, I've heard some other things that you should have addressed and checked for. Like if you snore, you should find out from your doctor, get the test for sleep apnea and get that addressed. Is that also important?
Yeah. So one of the things that a lot of people don't realize is that, you know, people say, oh, I sleep fine. Well, that may be that you feel okay, perhaps, but many people do snore while they sleep, or actually a lot of people stop breathing while they sleep for short periods of time. That's something called apnea, sleep apnea in particular. And so if you snore, or if you find that when you wake up you're not well rested, you definitely should have a sleep evaluation.
Yeah. Another area that seems to be growing in science, and you see all sorts of ads on TV, is once we get to a certain age, the belly fat comes on, and they talk about, you know, our declining testosterone and how that kind of helped us lose that weight before, and insulin resistance. Briefly address some of those issues that make it tough to get where you need to be.
Right. There's a lot of controversy about many of those topics. So what I would tell you is that central adiposity, which is the belly fat that you're talking about, is associated with worse cardiovascular outcomes. So it's important to eat in a lean and whole way and exercise plenty. And that typically gets people there. Now, many people need a little bit more of a push. You know, the body works very hard to maintain weight. So I usually tell people sometimes to not only go plant-based, which cuts out a major food group, but sometimes they have to restrict when they eat. So rather than sort of grazing all day long on whatever they like, maybe they only eat between, say, 11 a.m. and 5 p.m., something called intermittent fasting. And for some people, they actually do a lot better losing weight that way. But I think many times drastic changes are needed. So it's the fuel you put in, the amount you're burning with exercise, and then sometimes it's there's some other characteristics like the time you're eating as well. And so I usually tell people to try to have their biggest meal of the day at lunch rather than at dinner.
Yeah.
And sometimes those together work. In terms of insulin resistance, you know, a lot of people are pre-diabetic and, you know, they don't respond well to insulin. And a lot of that comes from fatty deposits in the muscles, fatty deposits in the liver. And if we can eat in a lower fat way, many times those fatty deposits will be depleted and everything starts working again. In terms of testosterone, there's been a number of very interesting studies in the last several months to years, you know, showing that you can have all the testosterone you need following a plant-based diet. I know a lot of people get concerned that if for some reason they don't eat meat, they won't have enough testosterone, but that's not true anymore. And the truth is testosterone and hormones can sometimes add risk, but in some patients, it's the right thing to do. And I usually recommend talking with their providers, their clinicians, about what the right strategy is, but realize that there's always a benefit and a risk to virtually everything we do.
All right. There's all sorts of gadgets out there. I see an ad on TV for this thing that you can put your thumbs on and see your heartbeat through your phone and then send it to your doctor. Is that something we all should be thinking about, or is that just for people who are in, you know, treatment for something having to do with the heart?
Yeah. So, you know, there's a whole slew, right? Many of the watches that are out in the current generation can measure EKGs. There are devices you can buy, as you mentioned. There's quite a few of them now. You know, in general, they're great things. And if you're trying to become an elite athlete, it might make sense to know more about your heart rate during exercise and at rest. Or more importantly, if you're having symptoms, like if you feel palpitations or if your heart skips or if you're passing out or things don't seem right, it might make sense to get snapshots of what your EKG or heart rhythm is doing. But by and large, I don't think everybody needs these things. And I sure as a doctor don't want to be inundated with 10,000 EKG strips every day.
Every day.
But they are helpful. And we do use, you know, medical grade type tools for the appropriate patients when they need them anyway.
Dr. Freeman, quickly go through the symptoms. I understand they're slightly different in men and women. So quickly announce what they are, when we should take it seriously and get call 911 or get ourselves to a doctor or a hospital.
So great question. I get this all the time. Is, doctor, how do I know I'm in trouble with my heart? So the truth is, you probably have all seen those people on TV where they hold their fist against their chest and they're aching in pain. Lots of people have chest pain, and chest pain that occurs particularly with activity or stress is a concerning sign. But I would also argue that any symptom that occurs above the waist with activity and resolves with rest can sometimes be angina or angina, as you'll hear people say. And so if you're having more of those, or if you're suddenly short of breath, or you're getting chest pain with just a little bit of walking where you never used to get that before, these are warning signs that you need to seek urgent or even emergent care. And I've had patients, and particularly in women, where they may not have chest pain, but rather they'll have neck fullness or jaw pain with activity that resolves with rest. So it's important to really pay attention when you have signs and symptoms that seem out of the norm for you.
All right. Quickly, some of the things that can go wrong. It's called the widowmaker. There's a particular vein or artery that if it bursts, it's really bad. What is that?
Yeah, so for clarity, the arteries don't typically burst in the heart. That could happen, I guess, but that would be unlikely. But many people are aware that the coronary arteries are the arteries that supply the heart muscle itself. And when they get suddenly blocked up, that's when a heart attack can occur. There is a particular area of susceptibility or danger, which is right off of the main left coronary artery that goes into the beginning part of what we call the left anterior descending or LAD artery. And if that gets a blockage, some people would call that the widow maker or widower maker these days, because men and women face heart disease equally as after a certain age. But in general, if you have a blockage there, these are scary. And it's very important to get those addressed. You know, there's been a lot of controversy over the years about when it makes sense to put in stents or do bypass. But in the widowmaker territory, the arteries that I just described, doing something is very important to improve outcomes overall.
All right. Lastly, you've got an important day coming up on the 29th. We have about 25 seconds. Go.
So World Heart Health Day is coming up, and it's important that everyone recognize that heart disease remains the number one killer worldwide. And it's important that we spend time recognizing the risks and what we do every day to improve those risks.
Happy Heart Health Day to you.
Same to you. Thank you.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.